Welcome, everyone, to the 103rd edition of the Patriot Hour. This is Sir Malachi, and we are live at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday, May 9th, 2010. Also, it is Mother's Day, so I hope all of you who are mothers had a great day. And along with me is General Rachel.
Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. Happy Mother's Day, all you mothers. I'm sorry. It's one of those days, right, Mel? I hope everybody had a great day with your moms and with everyone that you think are your moms or maybe you don't think are your moms. Whatever. I hope you had a wonderful day.
Yeah. Hey, Dakota, what'd you get your mom?
Oh, he made her something, Mr. Malachi.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. He made her a little crafty thing. Nice. Very manly, but nice, yeah.
Cool.
So I had a good day with my family, and my mom and dad are home, and it was wonderful to see them, of course. My family was all there, and big doings in our household this week. Of course, we have Sarah's graduation coming up on Saturday.
Woo!
And my nephew's graduating from college on Sunday next, so what a big week ahead, yeah.
Oh, next week, yeah, this weekend coming up, yeah. Yeah, it is. Sarah graduates on Saturday, and then Rachel's nephew on Sunday. All kinds of proms and graduations in high school coming up. Oh, boy.
I know. No, you kids out there, no drinking and driving. Prom season's big for that. Don't you be doing any of that nonsense. It's not worth it.
No, it isn't.
Worth it.
Nope.
So what'd you do today, Mel? Just hang out with Mom?
Yeah, I got her, her present.
Mm-hmm.
She got a couple of hanging planners from a couple of my other brothers and things like that, a bunch of nice cards and some instant lotteries and stuff. She's having fun.
Happy Mother's Day, Mom.
Yeah, happy Mother's Day, everyone.
Yeah.
Well, let's get down to the...
All right.
The real business, as the Asian markets are just opening up. We had 5 bank closings on Friday. Tally of bank failures in the U.S. for 2010 rose to 68 Friday after state regulators shuttered 4 community banks in 4 states. That don't make sense. That was 5 banks they closed, everyone. Bank failures in Florida, Minnesota, Arizona, California cost the FDIC fund a combined $213.7 million, which was much less than the $7.3 billion that the fund took a hit last week, and I reported. So I was a little low on my estimate. I said $6.5 billion. It was actually $7.3 billion last week. The Bank of Bonifay, Florida Office of Financial Regulation, shut down the Bank of Bonifay almost exactly 2 years after the street first discussed institutions non-performing construction loans, and we did say last summer that watch for commercial real estate to go belly up. In efforts to raise capital in the wake of downturn in local construction projects, the downturn was centered around a reduction in land development activities by the St. Joe Company. Bank of Bonifay had $243 million in total assets. The FDIC was appointed receiver and arranged for First Federal Bank of Florida of Lake City, Florida, to acquire the failed institution's deposits and $78 million in assets, with the agency retaining the rest for later disposition. Bank of Bonifay's 5 offices were set to reopen Monday as branches of First Federal. The bank failure cost the deposit, the FDIC and insurance fund, an estimated $78.7 million. Access Bank of Champlin, Minnesota, which had $32 million in total assets. The FDIC sold the bank for a small premium to Prins Bank of Prinsburg, Minnesota. Access Bank's 2 offices were to reopen during normal business hours as Prins Bank branches. The FDIC estimated the failure would cost the deposit insurance fund $5.5 million. Town Bank of Arizona, which had $120 million total assets, and was the main subsidiary of Town Bancorp. The FDIC sold the failed bank for a small premium to the Commerce Bank of Arizona of Tucson. with the agency agreeing to share in losses on $80 million of the acquired assets. Town Bank's office was scheduled to reopen Monday as Commerce Bank branch. The FDIC estimated bankruptcy would cost $41.8 million. First Pacific Bank of California, which had total assets of $336 million, the FDIC sold the failed bank's deposits for a 1.62% premium to City National Bank of L.A., which is held by City National. City National also agreed to take on the failed bank's assets, with the FDIC agreeing to share in losses on $276 million. Page 2, I gotta wait for page 2. The agency estimated that the First Pacific's failure would cost the insurance fund $87.7 million. The failed bank's six branches were scheduled to reopen Monday as City National Bank's Well, it was actually five, but they didn't have the fifth one on here for some reason. But it was five banks, raising the total to 68. So we're almost halfway to last year's total of 140. So, yeah, we'll be. Yeah. Here we go. It's right.
It's going to be a wild, wild financial week. Breaking tonight, as all of you I'm sure know, and we predicted it here, the European Union has now developed their own TARP, $928 billion worth. After a 14-hour emergency meeting today, European finance ministers put together an unprecedented loan package that may be worth 720 billion euro or $928 billion. For debt-swapped governments in a bid to restore faith in the euro and prevent Greece's fiscal woes from unleashing a global crisis. Now, what happened? Let's think about it. First, we had Greece, right, Mel? We had Greece collapse, and we knew it was going to.
Mm-hmm. We said it last year to watch for it.
The pigs fell. Basically, yep. The pigs all fell.
Yeah.
But there were other uncertainties happening. Spain, we told you, would be next. Portugal after that. Now, Italy is coming in next.
Double I, huh?
I'm thinking. I'm going PII with this. I am. Mm-hmm. Now what? But what else happened? And we're going to talk about the UK election, which was just beyond fascinating.
Up until about 4 in the morning when the counting pretty much stopped. And you know what amazes me is how well that the BBC polls knew exactly that the Conservatives were going to take 307 seats. They got that right on the money. And
yeah,
they were a little bit off on the voter turnout percentage, but that's all right. That amazes me how well their polls are.
We'll get into that when we get there. But we had that happen. All right, you had the uncertainty about that and Clegg being absolutely nothing more than a prima donna. And he is, and it'll work out in the way
it
should.
Well, Clegg's definitely not going to work with Brown because Brown chewed him on the phone.
No.
He's definitely going to work with Cameron.
All right, so you have that. You have that going on. You have your Greece situation going on. But you also had something that we told you to watch for that occurred today. And that was the German elections. And Merkel's party got nailed today. So what happens? They know this is coming ahead of time. Merkel did everything that she thought she had to do, and she knew that the German people were going to be as upset with her as the Greek population is upset with the Greek government. She knew. She did it anyway, whether we agree or disagree, look at quickly what happened. So now you have the European Union, and guess who's telling them to straighten their acts out? The United States. Are you kidding me? The United States is putting pressure upon the European Union. Get this mess straightened out because the markets are upset. Oh, you know what? If I was the European Union, and believe me, I'm no defender of the European Union, I would just hold a mirror up to Timothy Geithner and gang. Because you're starting to form some problems here. European Union and Geithner. I don't know who the hell we think we are. We have more problems, more than Greece. And I know most of you don't want to hear it, but it's the truth. So for 14 hours on a Sunday, the European Union gets together and says, we have to do something, or we are going to have a crash globally. Now, what did they know? What did they know that we weren't being told? Well, it's nothing that you wouldn't have known if you hadn't listened to us here. The French banks were about to collapse. Those French banks owned that Greek debt. Now, yes, we in turn, through the IMF and through our banks connected with those French banks, owned just not a lot, but enough. So I, you know, Mel, if you put it all together, think about it going backward logically. Yeah, it would have affected us again. They were worried that it was going to plunge us into that double dip, and we were going to hit, as I still predict we are, rock hard, solid to the ground. All they did was bomb it. That's all. $928 billion. Now, to us, we're like, well, what the hell? What's that? You know, what? That's a lot of money.
Yeah, what's another trillion?
It's all fake. It's a shell game.
Yeah.
To give investors confidence. What we said, remember when we talked about the euro and the dollar being parity? They're going to be on par. They're going to be parity, meaning they're going to be equal in currency.
They're getting
value.
Pretty close.
Yeah. And they couldn't have that. But who drove the market more? Now, you heard before when the European Union came out this morning and said, we need to get this done before the Asian markets open. I'm thinking, it has nothing to do with the damn. Remember when we were talking, Mel, I said, this doesn't have anything to do with the Asian markets. It was that German election result. The minute they heard about that election result, Merkel's like, listen, I don't know how much longer I'm going to be here. They vote no confidence, and here we go. Remember your parliaments, and we're going to talk about that because I really, boy, we got a good lesson on European government, which I thoroughly enjoyed, by the way. We're sort of now, we had a great time.
Mm-hmm.
But think about that. Now the euro, through the IMF and through your tax dollars, see, now you didn't think it would come back to get you, did you? Yeah. American people, you are once again, without your even knowledge or it might not even seem like it to you, you're now saving Europe again.
Yep.
How does that make you feel?
Yeah, right at the moment, the euro is down to $1.28. The pound
now
is down to $1.48.
That's where it closed. Was it closed at 120?
No, that's where it's at right now. That's
all
right,
so,
right now.
So it's up
Yeah, they just opened up the Asian market.
Yeah, and I know the Nikkei's up. I know that, and they're going to be. This news is going to buoy the Asian markets. I understand that. But
Hong Kong and India are both down about the same, 218 points.
I just don't think that the Asian markets are going to see through this. They are. And as we've said here, I really wish to stop with the emerging economies. They are the economy, okay? South America is the emerging economy. But Asia,
yeah,
they're the powerhouse.
But you see
Absolutely.
The inflation rate in Venezuela?
Now, what is it at now?
30%.
30%? Yeah, that's what I thought. 30%.
That's what you get for socialism.
Absolutely. But all the banks that were intertwined with this Greek debt, it was French. And we've brought that to you before. And that one bank that sticks in my mind, and I will never forget it. Societe Generale. Societe Generale to Europe is what Goldman Sachs is to the United States. That's the best analogy I can give you. And they first caught my attention, Mel, after the, quote, global crisis. When they made $1 billion in profit, remember? And I'm like, whoa. The whole world crumbles, yet Societe Generale makes $1 billion in profit? Nobody paid attention to it. So if you ever hear that name, consider them the Goldman Sachs of Europe. But all of these French banking houses had everything and all their money tied up in Greece and in Greek debt. Remember when Merkel said we need to prevent another Lehman Brothers for nations here? She kept saying that over and over again. That this little piddly amount that we're going to give Greece is not going to be enough, and we've said that. How could it be? Now, I know, you know, I don't want to beat a dead horse, and I'll move quickly through this, but I really am getting tired, very tired, of people not understanding this Greek, the Greek baklava thing. They want to mock it, make fun of it. Oh, the people can lie on the beach. What the heck do you people know? Are you working in Greece right now? You live there? I said this on Wednesday. I'm going to say it again. When you make a social compact with your people, whether we agree or disagree with the form of government that they have, don't tell me you wouldn't be in the streets, too. And don't think that you won't be when they come and tell you that you need to work another 5 years before you can retire. Or they tell you that your pensions are done. They're cut. They're going to have to. So it isn't about the Greek people being lazy or the French people or the German people. It's about them buying into a system of government that's a failure. And this European Union was a disaster. They tried to play America and they failed. They tried to unite their states and they failed.
You still have the sense enough to admit it.
Yeah, now, and you know what I was thinking too, when we were driving home, I don't know where these things come to me. They come to me in strange places, I can tell you that. Just now,
I'm not going to say where
her
best I'm not going to say where her best ideas come from.
Thank you. I think, you know what it is about they don't have the moxie that we have here. You remember I brought up the French governor or the Spanish governor in the Louisiana Territory when he said, "Don't underestimate these people." Yeah, they have the power of their states, but they have the country to protect them. We have such a unique form of government, and Europe tried to copy it. Now, they did it for an economic reason. They were sick and tired of being bullied. And, of course, you can conspiracy, you know, make your conspiracy theories whenever you wish. But we have to deal with what we know. The European Union's falling apart. And no matter how much money they throw at it, it can't change what's rotten. It's like this country, our country. We can throw fake monopoly money at it. We can make promises. But if the foundation's crap, it's coming down. Europe's falling apart, and I don't think it's a bad thing. I don't. I see people in Europe attaining their sovereignty back, their individuality back. So we can get into specifics, and we have. You know them by now. But now you're dealing with people on an individual level. We know who's behind the protest, and we understand all of that. But Grandma now is in the streets of Greece. And she's saying, "I've worked all my life. My husband here, Liz, has worked all his life. And now you're telling him to work another 14 years. This isn't just another 2 years. 53 to 67. That's a long time. And for everybody loving to mock them, you better be careful because it's coming here. Europe doesn't have a manufacturing base. We don't have a manufacturing base. What does Europe produce? Well, they're getting very good at what? Research and development as far as pharmaceuticals are concerned. Their cars, they're trying to bring back a little bit right now.
Yeah.
A little bit of green technology too over there. But they've become, like we have, consuming but there's a great big world outside of the United States. It's India, Indonesia, Taiwan, China, and South America. All for currency coming back is very real. The stock, the pound, what is there? The franc, the Deutschmark. That one currency idea has fallen apart. Now, even though the European ECB, the European Central Bank, and the IMF keep wanting to plug that, and the UN keeps wanting to plug it, even Asia has backed off that, even China, because they see what's happened. They want to hold on to their yuan. Wouldn't you? Of course you would. So what our markets will do tomorrow, I don't know. What the English or what the European markets will do? Well, that's what we want to talk about now, huh, Mel? European markets. And what happened in Europe? What happened in the UK? What an exciting election that was.
Yeah, it sure was. I enjoyed watching it.
I enjoyed watching it. I enjoyed watching the coverage of it. Granted, BBC, government-owned, we know all about it, everybody, we know. But what coverage they gave of this election. No commercials, no selling of Pampers. Straight line, full-out coverage. Like you said, Mel, their exit polls were spot on.
Yeah. Well, this is even before the voting started, even. They said it'd be about 307 seats for the conservatives and about 70% turnout, and they were right about the number of seats. They were, I think it was a little over 65% that turned out, which is still great, you know.
It sure is. And we know that you have less numbers, and we saw the whole process. We watched it for like 5 straight hours. I mean, it was amazing coverage. Because, one, the people were knowledgeable. Two, the opinions were cut to a minimum. Yes, they were. And when they ask their questions to politicians, they hold back, by the way. These media types over there, especially the older ones, went straight for it. There wasn't none of this bipartisan crap. So what happened over there? Well, succinctly put, they have a parliamentary government. So the best way to understand what's going on would be like in our Congress or in our House of Representatives, when they vote for Speaker, okay? They could vote for anybody. Anybody can get thrown up for Speaker, but the majority is going to call it, right? Those that have the majority. So the Democrats have the majority. More than likely, it will be a Democrat Speaker. But what if it's tied? Or say we had 3 parties in our Congress, and it was close, and you needed a majority to become Speaker. Well, you're going to have the leader party make deals. That's exactly what's happening over in Britain right now. Now, constitutionally, Brown is prime minister, and he has the constitutional right to get his government in order. Government is how they refer to it. So he has a constitutional right to form his coalition. He does not have to resign. But for the first time, was it 1931, Mel? I think it was 31. The conservatives gained this many seats. Since 1931.
Yeah.
Now it's at 306. I just watched it. 306 to the conservatives. 258. What was his party again? Labor Party. I forgot. 258 to the Labor Party. 7 to the
Liberal Democrats.
Liberal Democrats.
54 or something like that.
57.
57.
And then 28 to the others. Now Clegg is being an absolute prima donna. And he's over there thinking his doesn't stink, and he look, he's going to overplay this hand. But he, like I said before, and we called it before, he's going to form with Cameron. He's going to. And it's going to be the people in the Brown, in Labor Party, that's going to go up to Brown and say, it's over, Gordon. It's over. And it is over. When we watch them go through, I would just say districts, because I don't really remember. What did they call? Would they call them districts, Mel? I don't even remember now. Oh, shoot. When they went from, do you remember what they called them?
I thought they did call them districts, didn't they?
Well, I'm not, I think, but I don't want to, it's cool, but let's say we're districts, okay. When they went district to district, which they did on the BBC coverage, the most amazing statistic to me, I don't know about you, Mel, was the swing. They'd had this called swing meter, but what it was they'd show the absolute percentage swing since the last election that it went from Labor to Conservative. And that was what they, I think, based a lot of their projections on. They could see such a swing go to the Conservative side. Well, they knew. They knew ahead of time. Now, some could say it's because of the debt. Some could say that Gordon Brown's just an idiot, which he is. I mean, we could go on and on by why Gordon Brown lost. But it's coming back to what we're doing here. It's sovereignty. It was since the Lisbon Treaty. I knew 2 years ago that treaty was raising such hell within Great Britain. You all know Daniel Hannan. That is your Britain right there. But look at what happens in Europe. They're like, oh no. Will Britain, what will Britain do? Britain has its own currency. Its sterling is now relatively stable with the election of, well, the new government, we don't know yet which. Is Britain starting to get it back together, in other words? Are they starting to finally say, we're done with this immigration nonsense. We're done with all this giving out of money. We're done with the war. And I'm going to be point-blank honest with you. They're done, the people of Britain, with Afghanistan. They're finished. They are like we. Either fight it or end it. But there's one thing you don't have to worry about, and that's the relationship of Britain and the United States. It just, this is one of those relationships that it's not going to change, no matter who's president or who's prime minister. We're too much alike. And that election proved it to me. These people were saying the same things you are saying. And it's very easy to say, oh, the people in Europe, the people. Do you know the people in Europe? Do you talk to them? Could you pay what they pay in taxes? They're just conditioned to pay it. But they're starting to say, well, wait a minute now. I don't have enough pounds. You know, I don't have enough euros. We don't want to do it anymore. And we're hearing all this talk, but we're not seeing anything done. And this immigration nonsense, you know, we're done with that too. And we're not going to bail out Greece. So don't ask us for money. And here's Gordon Brown. Now, he did mail, he got 258 seats, and people might say that's a lot. It's the percentage that he lost. He lost, what, 70 or 80 seats, I think, Mel? Was it 71? What the heck?
Who did?
The Labor Party. They lost.
Oh, no, they lost 91, I think.
Okay. So that is a huge swing. So, yeah, they're having deals, and we said they were going to make the deals. The pressure now is to hurry up and make these deals. Now, there was one question I got asked, and it was answered that night, and it was about the Queen. Can she do anything? Well, no. Can she? Yes. Will she? Knowing QE2, we don't know. But she won't let it go on for long. Not if there's a crisis. She can call a new election. Did you know that? Or she can call anyone to form that government. So she can say she will invite them to the palace.
Yeah. Labor lost 91 seats and conservatives gained 97.
There you go. And there you go with that swing meter. It was that swing, that shift. And it was an amazing shift.
5% swing from labor to conservative.
That's a big swing. There was another interesting thing. Oh, finish with the Queen. She can call Cameron to Buckingham Palace. She could do it right now. She could pick up the phone and say, Mr. Cameron, come and present me your government. She won't, but she could. But if this doesn't get straightened out with all the problems now going on in the Eurozone, I would say by Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday at the latest, I wouldn't be surprised if QE2 put her toe in the water here. Because regardless of what we think, she's still ahead of the government. I know, but she is. Now, yes, she can vote, but they don't vote. Royalty has the right to vote, but she does not vote. It was just interesting. And then another interesting thing was that I told Mel about it. We were talking about it when they were doing it. When the election results are read in the district, every candidate lines up on stage. I mean, it's almost hokey, but it was just cool to see. And they have to stand there and listen to the results being read. So picture all of the people running in your district, lined up on a stage, almost like an adult spelling bee award or something, and they're told right then and there in the room, in front of the camera, no party headquarters, that. It reminded me of local government. It was very local. These people took it seriously. And in the clip mail that I uploaded on it, one of the MPs, Minister of Parliament, one of the MPs said, regardless of all that's going on, you have to understand, I represent people in my district. I don't represent the party. I said, can I get you a birth certificate, please? Look at what's happened. Now, do I want to see that kind of swing happen here? I do. But I certainly don't want it swung like we talked about, no need to go into it again, just in the general GOP direction. I want what happened in Europe happen to, like it happened to Bob Bennett, I want it to happen all across this country, GOP and Democrat alike.
Want me to play that clip?
Sure.
Let me go to the Liberal Democrat position. I'll come back to you, Harris, in a second. Evan Harris, the position now of the Liberal Democrats, the public out there will be looking to you to make a compromise and ensure the government continues, won't they? Isn't that your first priority? Or is your first priority to get what you want because you've got the power that Nick Clegg always said he didn't want, and it was the kingmaker was the role of the electorate, but actually you are the kingmakers in this situation.
I think he said he didn't want it at the time when people were about to vote.
It's been thrust on you now.
Well,
what are your duties?
The electorate has decided, even despite this distorted system designed for two parties, designed to create a majority, that no one party should govern on their own, or at least easily, because I agree with what Malcolm said, that there is another option there. And Nick Clegg's been absolutely consistent throughout. He said that if that was the outcome, and he didn't want to be drawn into it too much, but he did say this, then he would first see it as the responsibility or the right of the party with the biggest mandate, which is clearly the Conservatives,
yeah, we know
the votes and seats, to start to form a government.
We know
and that
this
means that the Conservatives,
yeah,
can negotiate with us, and that's
what
we're doing.
Duty, what duty do you see yourself under in the national interest as a party that is in the position to decide whether the Tories and David Cameron can govern?
You have to understand the huge pressure on Nick Clegg. He's under huge pressure from, I suspect, the party membership to go nowhere near the Conservatives. He's not ignoring that. He's sensitive to it. But he's being consistent with what you quite rightly describe as what the general public would expect, which is for him to see, not rule anything out, and do it in the right order, which is the Conservatives first, to see if a program can be agreed,
right,
either for coalition or for something short of that so-called, you know, confidence.
Can he bludgeon his party into accepting a deal if he says, look, I'm the leader of the party, I'm in charge of this? Or is he actually, because the Liberal Democrats, we know, are very much prone to pull their leaders down,
is he not
in a position to negotiate even?
Firstly, he's in a very strong position. I mean, I've had my own policy clashes with Nick, and people like me, even though I lost my seat, recognise that he's had a not just bravura performances in the TV debates, but a fantastic campaign from the beginning. However, it's not about attacking our leader. We're something which is unusual, called a democratic party, okay? And the parliamentary party, and you've described the process, will have to agree to something.
Right.
And I think it's going to be extremely difficult if there's nothing on, not just electoral reform, but cleaning up politics
right.
on a wider scale. I just don't see how that would be sellable. So there is
okay.
there is a difficulty, obviously.
We've not got all that much time this morning. This afternoon, I should say. Harriet Harman, wouldn't the thing that would best unlock some arrangement, you know what I'm going to say, B.F. Gordon Brown stood down, volunteered to stand down, or said he would stand down if a deal was done with Labour and the Liberal Democrats. Wouldn't that be the best way of continuing government?
Well, I don't think that that does necessarily unlock anything. I mean, what Nick Clegg has said is because the Tories have most votes and have got most MPs, he's going to speak to them on behalf of the Liberal Democrats first.
And they're the timetable.
And then, if he can't get an agreement with them, and if those talks succeed, then he will take David Cameron will take over in government, and we will no longer be in government. I mean, it's absolutely clear that the public have voted for change, but they haven't voted for a change in which somebody else governs
but
on their
it,
own.
But would
but
it be
I
a good
let
indication
me say
from Labour?
I think that I think what's very important in all of this is it's very unusual for us all to be sitting here after an election and not be knowing who is going to be Prime Minister and what the future government shape's going to be. But I think the critical importance here for the public is that we're completely open about what we're doing, so that we say, okay, we know that there are some circles that have got to be squared. We've all been elected on different programs which we strongly believe in, and that's our individual mandate.
That's the problem now with Parliament,
but we also
you know?
Got a bigger
Everyone's
public interest
elected on
mandate
different.
Of making sure that this country has
yeah.
strong and stable
but
government.
You can't do that with Gordon Brown. You've been defeated. He's been crushed in this election. A little man has been crushed. Surely a first step in the public interest for Labour would be for Gordon Brown to say, whatever happens, I'm standing down. That would put a breath of fresh air into the whole thing. You might even be able to do a deal with the Liberal Democrats that the public would accept. Because the thing the public can't accept is Gordon Brown.
I think the result of the inevitable result of the public vote is that there's going to be change, and that change does mean that we will not be governing on our own as majority
right, and
party
change
anymore.
Change means Gordon Brown standing down.
Well,
let's be frank.
I mean, that is actually putting the cart before the horse at the
well,
moment.
It might not
Nick
be.
Clegg,
it might be putting the horse before the cart.
No, it isn't, because Nick Clegg at the moment is not talking formally to us. Because he's in negotiation.
You could take the initiative.
Well, I don't actually, with respect, think that gestures are any point here. We've got
initiative
to go
might be the
into
point.
No. Well, I think we've got to go into a stable, very open process. The first part of the process is the Liberal Democrats are talking to the Conservatives. After that, if they choose, they'll be able to talk to us. But I think the main thing is we've got to be very open and have in mind the public interest, despite the fact that we were all elected as individual MPs
right.
for our own party.
Thank you very much indeed. Well, Liberal Democrats, we were hearing about the importance of Liberal Democrat and their party in judging this. The MPs and the peers are meeting in Westminster to consider these negotiations. They'll be giving their views about it. Laura Kunzberg is there for us. Laura. Good afternoon. What's going on?
It's been quite a chaotic morning here in Westminster at the local government association where the Lib Dems are meeting. They began with a meeting of the front bench team. So Chris Hughne, Vince Cable, Nick Clegg, Danny Alexander, all their top names were in there this morning. The team who had been with the Conservatives last night were relaying back the conversations that they had had to others here. And in about 10 minutes or so, Nick Clegg will be back here and having a meeting with every single one of the party's MPs. Now they are planning to
wow.
have what's been described as a very wide-ranging discussion. They are not at this point, as I understand it, talking about how they would vote on a deal that has been put on the table. They're not trying to make a kind of definitive decision here today. But of course it's very important for all of Nick Clegg's MPs to feel, as the Lib Dems would have it, that they've had their say, because if there is to be a deal on the table, Nick Clegg would have to get 75%, three quarters of the parliamentary party to approve it, And also, you have to get to the support of the party's Federal Executive Committee in order to be able to go ahead.
Oh,
now, there will be
man.
A meeting of that group at about 5 o'clock this afternoon. So this whole thing is going to go on for quite some time, but it feels very much like the first stage of something, rather than Mick Clegg coming here and saying, this is the deal, do we want to go ahead with it or not? Very little information about what has been put on the table by the Conservatives, although it's been suggested to me that 3 cabinet positions were offered. Potentially the Chief Secretary to the Treasury, potentially the Home Secretary, potentially also the Transport Secretary. The Lib Dems did not want to get into a conversation about whether or not these jobs were put on the table by the Conservatives. They said they want to talk about policy first. They have not been having discussions about jobs, but they didn't deny it either. But in essence, David, I think the main sticking point is going to be electoral reform. We've even seen a couple of protesters come down here this morning to stand outside the meeting with posters, essentially with a very clear message to Nick Clegg saying, be brave, ask for proportional representation. That is, I'm sure, a message he's going to be getting from many inside these meetings here today. But the question then is whether or not David Cameron will give any more ground on that. And for many Liberal Democrats, this will be a sticking point. If there is no copper-bottomed guarantee that there would be a vote on shaking up the way that Westminster works, then they may well not be willing to proceed.
Laura, thank you very much indeed. Laura Kunzel, keeping us all in touch with this, as she has done throughout. I'm joined now by 2 constitutional experts, Peter Hennessy, Professor of Contemporary History, and Robert Hazell, Professor in charge of the Constitutional Unit, who's written about it, and I've read all your papers on this. But just before we talk about the Constitution, Nick Robinson, we were talking with the 3 politicians about the deal. You were talking about how the numbers stack up. Is that the only way the government can carry on, or could there be a minority government without obvious all-party support?
You can have minority governments. Now, they have to be sure that they can get these crucial things through, the Queen's Speech, which, to remind people, is the list of the bills that the government wishes to pass for the year ahead, and the budget. If you can't get either of those through, you're not a government. But you can govern as minority so long as people in other parties agree not to bring you down, not, in other words, to form a majority against you.
Robert Hazell, do you think we have a constitutional crisis on our hands?
Yeah, we certainly don't.
Do you think we have the makings of a sensible deal in sight?
Well, that we don't yet know until the deal is done. But in terms of constitutional crisis, absolutely not. In any other country in Western Europe, the situation after our election would be perfectly normal. Of the 30 countries in Western Europe, there are only 3 that have single-party majority governments. So it's perfectly normal after an election for the political parties to have to work out who can command the most support in the new parliament and form a government. Westminster politicians, deeply rooted in our majoritarian tradition, used to there being a result within 24 hours of an election. It's a very big adjustment to come to terms with. I think the civil service are actually much better prepared for this eventuality than the political parties, because they've been preparing very hard for this for the last 6 months or more, hence the new cabinet manual that Gus O'Donnell published, the key draft chapter of, the one on elections and government formation in February, and so they are ahead of the game in terms of being ready for the situation we're now in.
But curiously, Peter Hennessy, this is this is what would happen if we did have proportional representation,
oh, yes.
Isn't it? I mean, we're getting a sort of first act.
Indeed.
Yes.
But if we did, we'd get used to it. The nervous system of British politics expects quick and brutal evictions and very efficient and swift arrivals.
And
it means that our nervous system isn't used to this, and so the ganglia are flapping. That's what Nick and his colleagues are doing. They're kind of neurosurgeons to be disturbed.
but there is a kind of insistence, this is what we stand for. You heard the 3 of them, this is what we stand for, this is what we stand for, this is what we stand for. Yeah. And it seems unconscionable in a way to them. They still think tribally.
They do.
Whether rightly or wrongly, I don't know. But
yesterday,
you know, our supporters of the Liberal Democrats would never forgive us if he did this.
Yesterday, all their 3 leaders really did rise to the level of events. It was very, very impressive. One of the most impressive days in British politics I can ever remember.
Interesting.
Yeah, and some people want parliamentary government here. And Dutch. You know how much often the government would be at a standstill if we had that here?
You know, in proportional government, and this is something that I could not believe. They want to be more like us, and that's the honest truth, because every one of their districts, I think, it looks like a hexagon. They want proportional government. Well, if they do that in England, it'll look like one big California. So we find, Mel and I, when we were watching it, we were, you could just tell as the results were coming in where your liberal states were or liberal sections were, where the population centers were. But they want to change it from set districts to proportional government. That would be huge in England, Mel. Huge.
Meaning like what they do here every 10 years, redistrict?
Right. Proportion by number of population within the district. It would be, you would have, you know what would happen, I think. You would have a solid, you would always be liberal. England would always be liberal. The interesting thing, too, remember, Mel, we were looking at the results. England proper, the island of Great Britain itself, solidly voted conservative. Where,
yeah,
the majority of the social or the social liberals and the very liberal came was from
Scotland
and Northern Ireland.
Yeah. And the northern part of, oh, the one, now, yeah, that's still Scotland, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Wales.
Yeah, the majority of Wales.
But 199 out of the 306 went conservative. And if you work out the numbers, it's 2-for-1. It was a 2-to-1. That's why the man on the BBC said the conservatives had the majority. They had a solid mandate. What he was referring to is England proper.
Well, the link I just put in the chat room is a map of England.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting.
It is. It's fascinating. And the reason we bring it up is because it's coming here. That is the kind of election we are going to see here, for good or for bad. Now, they want to be more like us, but I suggest, in all humility, we should take a little look at their system, not parliamentary system, but the humility in which they become elected. It was refreshing to see. It was refreshing to see that turnout. It was refreshing to see the way the politicians, and that's what they are, and that's what they refer themselves to be, were interacting with the very people they voted for. It wasn't that typical handshake nonsense. It was, hey, Joe, how's your cow kind of thing. They know these people. They live there. This is what I want to get back to. So just because it's Europe doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad thing. Remember, we come from England. All of what we have is based on the English governmental system. So maybe we can learn a little bit about how elections should not only be reported, but how politicians should act. It isn't all about Washington, in other words. Those people were invested in this election. As Mel said, the turnout was astounding. Absolutely. They were like 75%, 67%. Could you imagine if we had that legitimate kind of turnout here? It would be wonderful to see that, but we won't, but because it'll all be illegal.
Yeah.
But before we go on to other stuff, Mel, why don't we give him some good news about Mr. Bennett?
You want me to play that?
Sure.
Bob Bennett, ousted as Utah senator. This is about a 3-minute clip.
Meanwhile, Senator Bob Bennett has served the state in Washington for 18 years, but next year he will not be there.
Republican state delegates voted instead to send Bennett's challengers, Tim Bridgewater and Mike Lee, to a primary, leaving Bennett on the sidelines. Richard Pyatt has today's developments.
The anti-incumbent sentiment carried the day in the U.S. Senate race. Bob Bennett pulled out all the stops, but it wasn't enough. The majority of Republican delegates were not swayed by Mitt Romney, who got a mixed reaction introducing Senator Bob Bennett.
We need Bob Bennett's skill and intellect and loyalty and power.
After two rounds of balloting, Senator Bennett was out of the race. After three rounds, Tim Bridgewater and Mike Lee emerged as rivals in the June 22nd primary. Each of them now says they're ready for the next test, this time with voters.
Focus is always going to be on constitutionally limited government. That's what my campaign has been focused on since I announced on January 5th.
I'm a businessman. He's an attorney. We have different perspectives on how to solve problems in Washington. And I hope that the voters will respond to my campaign and my message.
For Bennett, it was an emotional final appearance at the convention.
The political atmosphere obviously has been toxic. And it's very clear that some of the votes that I have cast have added to the toxic environment. I offer my congratulations, as I say, to whoever wins. But I assure him he will not have any more loyal, dedicated, or efficient staff than I have had.
For the 3,400 delegates, this was not a decision they took lightly.
It was very difficult. I've been contemplating this for several weeks, and until just before I voted, I wasn't sure how I was going to vote.
For the last 2 weeks, I thought I had the candidate I wanted, and I got here, and I changed my mind.
The next step for these Republicans is the primary. Lee will face Bridgewater. The stakes have just gotten higher. Richard Pyatt, KSL 5 News.
Thanks, Rich. The Democratic National Committee was quick to respond to Bennett's loss today. Chairman Tim Kaines issued a statement from Washington saying, in part, "Today the Tea Party strengthened its hold on the Republican Party by ousting Utah Senator Bennett at the primary. That the Tea Party would consider Bob Bennett one of the most conservative members of the U.S. Senate, too liberal, just goes to show how extreme the Tea Party is." Kaines added that there's no doubt that the Republican leadership has now handed the reins to the Tea Party.
Democrat.
Yeah.
That was.
Yeah.
Oh, we knew this was coming.
Yeah.
We knew it was coming. And if you know Utah politics, this is shocking. But there's a reason. And I'm going to be very blunt about it. The church elders no longer matter as much as they used to. And that is just a fact. It's not a diss against people who are Mormon. It is a fact. Now, Bob Bennett is the old guard. He's the Bob Dole type. He's the John McCain type. Get him out. All of them need to go. And I saw Bob Bennett. I've never seen him emotional in all the years I've watched him as a senator. But I think he was truly shocked. What you saw, the reaction of Bennett, is what I think the GOP is going to be in for a very big reaction the same way. They don't fully get it yet.
They
think they've harnessed the Tea Party, that it's theirs to claim. And I really hate that, but the movement they call the Tea Party. They think they've harnessed it, and as we said before, they're going to use it. But, you know, we're not all the same flavor tea here. What happened to Bennett, better wake up. Every single politician. Now, Mr. Bennett, I'm sure you've done your best, but you're also the wealthiest man in the Senate. Get out. Go retire. Go on. All of you need to go. There's a new generation coming up. Now, whether this was, quote, Tea Party focused, I don't know. I don't really think so. I think that's overblown to be stated, and I think they use that term just for lack of a better one now in the media. I think they just use it. Because in tomorrow's Wall Street Journal, the headline will read, "Overthrow, a sign of Tea Party clout." What Tea Party clout? That's you. That's the people of Utah. There's a quote here, Mel, from a 72-year-old nurse. 72-year-old, and she said he doesn't represent us anymore. He doesn't represent the people of Utah. He got too liberal. He got too bipartisan. When you hear things in England as saying getting 306 to 258 is a mandate, what does that tell you? That we think things differently here. We need to think more like they do in England, where a 50-seat difference is considered a mandate. here we'd be, you know, wringing our hands over bipartisan committees. And no, you won, you won. You lost, you lost. But it doesn't mean you stop fighting for what you believe in. Anybody ever watch Parliament? We need some of that here. And that's what you saw. And I think Bennett Mail was really deeply shocked. He knew he was going to lose, but I didn't think he didn't think he was going to take the thumping he took. I mean, I think he got only, let me see, 27% of the vote. And to Chairman Kaine of the DNC, come on, you can do a little better than that, can't you? Right-wing, radical, nuts, come on, it's getting tired. You see nothing yet. John McCain's going to go too. And despite the polls, I think, I truly do believe, Rubio, don't you, man? Because you were telling me about the poll with Chris. Now.
Yeah, after he declared independent, they said on drugs that he was in the lead.
Yeah, because it's been split three ways. But the third party, he's gaining them. He's getting it. Now, there are a lot of conservatives who support him, and his name is escaping me right now. Someone help me out quick. What the heck is that guy's name? Shoot. The third one, a lot of conservatives support him in that Florida race, and it's just escaping me right now.
I don't know.
Sugar. It just slipped my mind right in, right out, and I'm sorry about that. But there are a lot of conservatives supporting him, a lot of independents supporting him. You know, normally, if this was Rachel of a couple years ago, I would be angry with you. I would tell you to stop. You know, I'm not going to. You vote your principal. Party be damned. Party be damned. Send a message. You send your message. Now, I'm sure there's people in Utah going, you know, Utah, they don't have to worry. There is no way that they're going to elect a Democrat senator in Utah. It simply isn't going to happen. Okay? So I'm not worried about the seat. But the people were speaking. Now, Rubio has 65% of the Hispanic vote. That's pretty solid. But you know what? You vote for who you want. And if Rubio doesn't represent you, and if Chris doesn't represent you, then vote for that nice man whose name, for gosh sakes, I cannot remember. Oh, my goodness. Vote for him. But don't worry about it. You know, the Democrats are going through the same thing in Pennsylvania. Sestak's pulling ahead of Specter. Now, we know the reason Specter changed parties is because he knew he was going to lose. He's a politician's snake. He is a snaky one, that Specter. But the Democrats don't like him. You're seeing the old guard, no matter what party, no matter what party now, being told, get out. You're seeing a purge on the right and a purge on the left. Why? Because regardless of what they tell a poll and regardless of what the media wants to say to you, we're done with this middle-of-the-road, mushy-mouth nonsense. You're either right or you're left. We're at a fork. Take your pick on a road. We're no longer, as Margaret Thatcher said, going to be political roadkill. Because that's all you are when you drive down the middle of the road in politics. There has been no great moderate arise in history. They just simply don't. I mean, every politician that conservatives like to rah-rah, well, they're always the one. They're always considered the radicals. Well, then why do you rah-rah them if you come out and tell me you're a moderate? No, you're not. You're lying to yourself. And that Utah vote, I tell you, that Utah vote better tell you, stop lying. Because if they can kick him out, they can kick anybody out. John McCain.
You said the third guy in Florida was who?
Yeah. What's his name?
Democrat?
I can't remember.
A Democrat?
No, he's a Republican. Or is he the Democrat? What the heck's his name? I can't remember. It's driving me nuts.
I got a list of the candidates running for the office. There's one, Tyrone Brown.
Okay.
There's Kevin Burns. There's Maurice Ferrari, or Barack Ferrari. There's Chuck Lynch. Kendrick Meek. Lawrence Tenpeck.
Meek.
Okay.
And how much, what's his registration? Party affiliation? Okay.
Democrat.
He's the one that came in third. And it was split. And it was split pretty good. And I know a lot of people are saying, well, you know, Chris did this. It doesn't matter, does it? In my opinion, those that are voting for Chris, I don't want them in the movement. They're the moderate, middle-of-the-road nonsense people. They're your establishment people. They're your 27 to 30% problem in this country. People often ask, why do I like European politics? Because it's more real to me. Why do I watch when I see it in South Korea, when people are diving over their desk to go punch out the Speaker of the House? Because it's real to me. It might be raw. You might consider it not graceful or whatever, but it's real, isn't it? These people mean it when they go there. This isn't a game to them. We play a game here. Who can get on camera first? Who should be on C-SPAN? Who's going to go out and give the one-minute speech or be on Matthew's show or whomever? This isn't a game. And the people in Europe, for all their faults and the governments that they've chosen them. And they know it now, and they're doing whatever they can, riot to whatever, to fix it. And you know what? I wish them well. I want them to get their sovereignty back, get their nationalities back, get their damn currencies back. Boy, now I knew the minute they gave up their currency, it was going downhill right from there. I know it doesn't seem like a lot, but it's huge. I want them to get sovereign. I want them to be Greece again and French again and Spanish and German and English. I want them to be proud of that again. And I want us to be proud, to be American again. This global nonsense gives me nothing more than nausea. I can't stand it, and it's garbage. It doesn't mean you're not international, but there's nothing wrong with being intranational either. The big bad word, nationalism, is not such a bad thing when you define it properly. We're not talking about, you know, jackboot Hitler types here. But don't be surprised if you start to see that. Although, Mel, we were surprised that the British National Party did not do very well in the election.
No, they didn't. I don't even think they got a seat, did they?
I don't think
so.
No,
they didn't, no.
No?
No.
Which really surprised me. We thought they'd pick up at least maybe 2, 3 to 5 seats. They didn't pick anything up. So that tells me that the electorate in England decided, you know what? We got to stop playing around here. Doesn't mean that they weren't voting for what they believed in. They were voting to get England back. And we need to do the same here. And that's why you see Bennett get thrown out. And yes, you're probably going to see Rand Paul win that primary in Kentucky. And I think in the end, you will see Rubio win the election. We'll have to wait and see. But the old names now, I think, are going to go into the record books, in history books. I just have this feeling, and I don't want the National Tea Party people to think it's them, because you know what? We're turning our backs on anything that's an organization. I don't want to be connected with organizations.
I want it to be local again. Don't make me care about what happens with the Utah senator. Yet I have to worry about that, or you know, Florida or wherever, because his vote, obviously, as we know, changes health care. You know, one vote changes your life. It shouldn't be that way. And I think you saw the real Britain in that election, and I think you saw the real Utah, a very young Utah, coming forward. And they're saying, you know what, you voted for that stupid bailout. We told you not to, but you did it anyway. You didn't listen because you assumed that your seat would be safe, Senator Bennett. Well, guess what? You're fired. He got fired in front of everybody, in front of the country. And John McCain's going to get fired, too. He can try and lie and pretend that he was always this way. No, he wasn't. We all know that.
No, yeah, he's just saying all this to try to get reelected. Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, like I told you a few days back, and the latest poll that I found was 2 weeks, a little over two weeks ago now, and Hayworth was only about 5% back. It's probably more dead even now.
Oh, could be. I mean, look what's happening out in L.A. or in California, where you had the L.A. Times editorial page refuse for the first time to endorse Senator Boxer. They refused.
Wow.
They said that she didn't have the clout that she used to have. Let's just think about that. They refused to take a position. This is the L.A. Times op-ed page. They said, no, we can't.
Yeah.
We're not going to take a position. That has to be a huge blow to Boxer. Just forget about how we feel about her. Think of it politically. She's got to be going, oh, my God.
Which perfectly ties in with the clip I uploaded.
Sure.
This is a professor at UCLA speaking to a bunch of Illinoisans who graduated from UCLA. And I also like to mention that the professor is also an illegal alien.
Oh, nice.
Mm-hmm.
I want to start out by saying that the young man who spoke a little while ago was one of my students. And that made me so proud because
Woo!
I know that our people have strong leaders for years and years to come. As a militante of Unión del Barrio, a revolutionary Mexican organization here, we understand what the camarada is saying. You're right, this is not just about Mexico. This is about a global struggle against imperialism and capitalism.
Yes.
But we know that all of that is happening in the context of where we now stand is stolen, occupied Mexico.
Yeah.
And the message that we bring is we want to bring a little bit of more of a revolutionary context to this. Why is it that these people, these frail, racist white people, want to keep us out of this country? It's not because simply the color of our skin. It's not simply because they just want to exploit us. Let me tell you why. Because on this planet right now, of 6 billion people, at the forefront of the revolutionary movement is the raza. When you go to Venezuela, we have a long history and example of our comandante, Fidel Castro Ruz. We got Hugo Chavez, Evo Morales, we got Brazil, Ecuador, you name it. We have nine left of center governments in Latin America right now. And they know something that one young Argentine called Che Guevara said. It was called the domino theory. And he knew that every single country would go revolutionary, one after the other, after the other, after the other. So what do they fear? They know that every single country, they know that we no longer will fall to these lies called borders. We know that a Salvadoran and a Guatemalan and a Nicaraguense and a Mexicano, there's no damn difference. We are all one people. So with that in mind, we see ourselves, all of us here, as the northern front of a Latin American revolutionary movement. There are more than 40 million of our people north of the Rio Grande. That means to them, there's 40 million potential revolutionaries north of the border, inside the belly of the beast. So when you think about why do they want to kick us, of all people, out, that's why. Because they know that we now know the truth. They know that now we are raza, we're professionals, we're educators, we are revolutionary students. What does that mean? We are not just a regular culture anymore. We're a culture of revolutionary spirit. And that's the fear. So with that being said, I want to leave you with this. As a revolutionary, and with revolutionary context, let's be clear about one thing. Our enemy is not the Minutemen. Quote me. Our enemy is not the Minutemen. Because the Minutemen are not the ones who have killed over 4,600 people at those borders. That our enemy is the same enemy as Hugo Chavez. That Hugo Chavez has. Our enemy is the same enemy that keeps Africa poor. Our enemy is the same enemy that keeps Asia poor. Our enemy is capitalism and imperialism. Okay?
The burrito.
If we are serious about making change, if you are serious about making change, let me tell you, the struggle will go on for many more years after we leave UCLA. Reading a book or writing a book or teaching a class, that is not part of the movement. What you do 24 hours a day as a professional revolutionary, that is what is going to lead our people and all people to liberation.
Yeah,
and there you go. And that could be part of the reason why boxing is losing its popularity.
Go to Burrito Bill. That made me... Oh.
I know.
I mean, we've all read this week, oh, and there's some breaking news, just so everyone knows, and now there shoots my day off to hell tomorrow. The Grand Imam will make his Supreme Court choice tomorrow, and I predicted it would be Kagan a month ago. I stand by that, so get ready for that all day tomorrow. Bubbly. Now I got to dive into that Simbo's works for the next month.
She's another ugly one, man.
God.
They had to pick her on drugs for the years.
Aren't they all? Man. Well, these ladies need to do a
little something. Yeah, Sotomayor, Ginsburg, and her. Yeah.
But, you know, anyway, that clip. That's a great clip because what does it say to you? We've heard this week about all of the Mexicans, of the kids, and the t-shirts, and the flags. We are at war. I've said it before, I say it again. We have an invasion from the south. Everyone knows what Reconquista is. Everyone knows that they're coming. They've been wanting to do it for years, and now they're doing it. And they come on our soil, yes, our soil. And they preach this. But Malachi or I say the word revolution, and it causes some sort of stir.
Yeah, we're racist and all this and that. And, well, that don't even bother me anymore.
No, me either. I like my race. Sorry,
yeah,
I do.
What the hell's wrong with it?
And now that we're a minority, or soon to be, I suggest you all be proud of who you are and start perpetuating your race if you're able. Because you're not going to have anything left in this country. See, Europe's finding that out. Yeah, that's why we talk about them, because they're ahead of us politically and socially as far as cycle's concerned. They're ahead. We're going to be that way. But I don't, you know, we say the same things over and over. You know what they are. But now they're bold. That's bold, that statement. That's in your face. 60 stuff. But these people are militant like they were in the 70s, huh, Mal? I mean, this to me is almost Mexican Black Pantherish. You know?
Yeah, that's what Raza is.
Yeah? This isn't anything new to all of us that are old enough to remember. Black power. You know, they meant it. Now they became diluted. And now, of course, they're running your government. But this coming up, this Mexican nonsense, which is what it is, this Reconquista, these students saying, you owe me an apology because you disrespected our flag, get out. Sweetheart, get out. Get out of my country. I don't owe you anything. I don't owe you land. I don't owe you money. I don't owe you anything. And if you dare burn my flag, that was it. I love my Supreme Court, but to say burning the American flag is speech makes my head want to explode. It makes it want to just blow right off. Personally,
yeah.
I'm not saying I'm changing. Oh, go ahead, Nate.
That's just it. You know, those girls burn the Mexican flag and they get suspended from school. Another kid in Texas gets suspended because he lowered the Mexican flag because it was higher than the U.S. flag.
I pulled my kid out of that school so fast. And then I sue the school for reverse discrimination. I would. Oh, you parents, I don't know how you do it. I don't know how you do it out there. Hardest job on the planet. Having, if you have no other choice but to send him to a public school. You got to be as vigilant as you would anything. More so, hyper-vigilant. This is where you got to rely on what you teach them and what you instill in them. And I don't care if they call you nerdy. I don't care if they're bored. Shoot, when they're sleeping, stick little ear things on their head so it goes into their brain. Do something. Because we can't lose this generation. Although I did a little research this weekend, and I'm going to say this. I can assure you of one thing, which I am very happy to hear. This generation coming up, I'd say between the ages of 20 and 25, I call them the 9/11 generation. This generation, they're like you and I. Mm-hmm. And they don't like being told what to do. Not by the parents, but by the what they call illegals. They talk like us. They act like us. And remember, they've been formulated since 9/11. They want their country protected. They want a chance to make money, to have a family. And they're sick and tired of it. But, Mel, as you and I were talking, it's going to take that generation. It's going to. They're going to have to fight this.
Yep.
But Boxer can't, you know, I'm going to tell you, and also something we haven't talked about briefly, we will, with the dilution of Acorn being fundamentally out there this coming election, and it will be hard felt by the Democrats. Sure it will. They relied on them. Either fake the vote or get the vote out. And while we talk about the unions, I also see something changing there as well. That's another reason why they won. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a great book that came out last week called The Manchurian President. And I suggest you read it. It's a good read. Tells you how it goes in a lot deeper. Aaron Klein wrote it. Goes into a lot deeper detail of his ties with Acorn and Bill Ayers. And he knew Bill Ayers long before. He said, claimed.
Oh, yeah.
And when he was a kid, he was going to this radical church. So, yeah, it's a good read.
Yeah. Good.
I recommend you get it. That's
okay.
Manchurian President by Aaron Klein. It's only $20.
Now, this is breaking now. Also, it's going to be one of those nights, isn't it? European ministers, Mal, offer to buy not just public debt, but private debt as well. They're buying public and private debt. Jesus. Oh, sorry for the Jesus. Sorry about that. This is huge. They're buying all the debt. Oh, I just got like little chills. This is like a sci-fi movie. All I see in my mind is the movie Metropolis. What are we doing here? If they think they're going to be able to do this to the people in Europe, after what we saw in Greece, I look, Mel, for this week to be decisive in this year's history. Something's wrong here. They will defend the euro, whatever it takes. Oh, gosh. And they now admit that this whole plan is to support the currency. This week will be decisive in our history. Something's wrong. I feel it to my core. It's the kind of feeling you have where everything's prickly, electric. Something's definitely changing. I don't know if it's for the good or the bad, or whether we're about to hit a spark or a clash. Have things now, are we just at the point where we really literally, without exaggeration, can't take it anymore? Where governments would come out and say, this is what we're going to do, and like I always like to say, we have this unspoken trust or a social compact where we will agree, and we're no longer agreeing. I think so. I think we're at that point.
Well, all the Asian markets are up except India.
What's India at?
It's still at 218, so I don't know if they're opening or not.
Now, is that the Bombay? Or is that the one I never can pronounce? Bombay? Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're on a holiday or not. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, they could be because it hasn't moved. The other three are moving, but not that. They're all on the plus side by quite a bit.
Well, it's because of that. It's because of the big emergency fund. Yeah, and I'm sure there's other reasons as well, which we'll find out soon. But Moody's is also warning America, don't worry, your shock will hit by 2013. Well, it's 2010 now.
Yeah, I think it's going to happen sooner, actually.
Oh, I do, too.
They keep trying to spend this money that we don't have.
Sure, I do, too. I absolutely agree. Yeah, Lena, ugly little piece of dung. I'll be reading her stuff tomorrow. A very important event occurred some 65 years ago.
Yeah, I was just going to get ready to play it.
That's my guy. Hit it.
Okay. Yep.
This is a solemn but glorious hour. I wish that Franklin D. Roosevelt had lived to see this day. General Eisenhower informs me that the forces of Germany have surrendered to the United Nations. The flags of freedom fly all over Europe. For this victory, we join in offering our thanks to the Providence which has guided and sustained us through the dark days of adversity and into light.
Oh no. Did it die out?
I don't hear nothing.
This called forth cheering throngs, hysterically happy that victory.
What?
What happened? What happened?
I don't know, Rachel.
Well, it loaded fine. I'm sorry about that.
Well, it was victory over Europe. In Europe, on May the 8th, it was officially declared.
Yes. Can you imagine that day?
Oh,
I tried I try to imagine it, you know. I try to imagine what it would be like. We can't imagine it. Oh, here we go.
Dean, just hurry!
zu erhalten ist unsere heilige und höchste Aufgabe.
I don't know what happened. Excuse me, we're not supporting Hitler. We don't know what the heck happened.
Yeah, I shut it off. So.
Something must have happened, because I don't...
Must have been one of those ambient moments.
No, I didn't. No, first of all, I did it like 2 hours ago, and it worked fine. So I don't know what happened there, and I want to know what happened there, because that was perfectly fine. I'm going to find out what happened today. There. Anyway, yeah, 65 years ago, it was over with. We don't understand. See, unless you lived it, you wouldn't understand. See, there were no men around. They were gone. And finally, that day was coming when the darkness and the world was going to be over with.
Yeah. What's really surprising, you know, it took another 4 months almost before Japan finally surrendered. 3 months and 3 weeks.
Thank
but
God.
Tell them what happened in Red Square.
Do I have to?
On Mother's Day, yeah.
For the first time, our United States military marched in Red Square. I'm sorry, but it's the truth.
You might want to repeat that.
For the first time, our United States active military marched as guests in the Russian parade in Red Square. Never before in history have active duty American troops been invited to march in the Victory Day parade, according to the United States military. The occasion is the 65th anniversary of the defeat of Nazi Germany in World War II, a date that carries an almost sacred meaning in Russia. Russian leaders have taken pains to explain that the Americans, along with the contingent of Britain, France, and Poland, were invited as representatives of the, quote, anti-Hitler coalition. That's what they call it, the anti-Hitler coalition. We couldn't believe it, could we? When we read that article, we said we never thought we'd live to see the day that active United States military would be allowed to march in Red Square. This made my blood boil. What are we doing there? By the way, all under the auspices of NATO. I watched the tape. I saw it. I'm wondering if that, I bet you I know what happened. Okay. No, Malachi, no. This is fundamentally wrong. I can't believe that we would allow this to occur. This isn't the Soviet Union. This isn't, I mean, this isn't Russia. This isn't this wonderful, this is the Soviet Union with Putin. This is a communist state. I don't care what anybody tells you. That's who they are. Our active military should not be there. This is wrong. I don't give a damn what Britain or Poland or anybody else does. France, who the hell cares? They don't even know what they're doing half the time, militarily wise. Now you have Obama. Get this, Neil. He's ordering the Crystal Light and the Karzai government to get along better. But I could not believe my eyes. This is the man running and allowing such things to occur. He sends your military to march in Red Square. No problem, no big deal. Orders the Muslims, like he has any control, by the way, because Karzai is going to be here this week, ordering the Crystal Light to get along better, like he's not already, right, Neil? And here's this... He's already saying Sharia law is fine. He doesn't like the tension, Barack Obama. He doesn't like it. Now, we speak about the 65th anniversary of the ending of the war, the most hellish thing our world has ever seen, a true world at war. I didn't hear Barack Obama mention it once. Instead of being at some college somewhere, he should have been at Arlington. He should have been in Washington. He didn't say anything. This, to me, is as great a diss as he did in Normandy when he dissed Sarkozy. He likes to bring the military up when he needs them, but he never mentions them, rarely, if that, or it's a little sentence somewhere. I hate to say it, but it's true. Michelle Obama mentions them more than he does. What greater honor would there be than to be President of the United States 65 years after your nation saved Europe? To remember those that gave their lives. To remember those that are giving their lives again for the safety of Europe and us. Fighting an enemy that is hell-bent on destroying the world. What greater honor? But he's too busy giving a commencement speech to a bunch of morons bitching and complaining about iPods and Xboxes. He's a disgrace. So we have Secretary Gates, of all people, that mealy-mouthed piece of dung.
Oh, you know what that idiot said? Or
what?
Yeah, no, the Pentagon. You know what the Pentagon told Congress?
What?
Quit spending so much money on the soldiers.
Jeez, mother of mercy.
I'm serious. It was on Drudge today.
Yeah, my power was out all day yesterday, so I'm like catching up. Are you...
I didn't read the whole article. I don't know who said it, but that's what the title said. The Pentagon said, told Congress not to.
I'm in
shock.
You know, these are one of those times, like,
find the article and I can...
These are one of those times where you can say nothing. You're getting a real shot of what I go through when I see and read things. I want to explode. Where was the joy today? Where was the worldwide celebration of defeating the greatest enemy to date they had ever seen? Where was Obama today? And don't, you know, I'm not doing this to be partisan. He's president of the United States. Where was he? Giving a commencement speech? He's a disgrace. Malachi, he makes me so angry I can literally feel the blood in my veins boiling. So there's your greatest generation going. In case anybody wants to know, we're all trying to remember this day and the friends we lost and the husband and the son and everybody that we lost and the people that came home and the people that are still missing that will never come home. But he sends that moron Gates to stand up there and make some stupid comments that fell on deaf ears. Nobody was paying attention. The damn Russians showed us up. Where's our national pride? Where is that gone? You got fathers, you got uncles, you got somebody, talk to them. Did you talk to them today? Did you ask them what they felt like when they heard the news? That's your husband, your son, your brother. They're coming home. Maybe, hopefully, that it was over. I know. See, I know it's so long ago. I understand that. But what's happening is that generation is dying. And I'm afraid with it, like we talked about last week, the rewriting of World War II is happening right before our eyes. Even with Putin now, the anti-Hitler coalition, what the hell does that mean? And you all know we've read to you here about Uncle Joe making a return over in Russia. They had to decide, Mal, whether they were going to fly banners of Joseph Stalin in the parade route, knowing that our troops were going to be marching down that red square. Mm-hmm. They decided against it, not to put it in public view. That we would even consider allowing active, not even volunteer, this is active military, to go over there and march in that square of death. I don't care if this was preordained or pre-made by any president. I don't care. Don't even tell me. I don't want to know. The point is that they were there. It's an outrage. And it's an outrage that nobody paid attention to it today. I didn't hear about it anywhere, Mel. I had to look it up online to see the things going on. And over in London, they were laying wreaths at their Tomb of the Unknown. And the three that were laying the wreaths were the three we began the show with, Cameron, Brown, and Clegg. We had Robert Gates in front of a microphone, and he was too short to reach it, and nobody was paying attention.
Yeah, here's that article that was on Drudge. I had to speak for it. It was posted on the Washington Post Saturday, written by Craig Whitlock. Pentagon, usually known for its frugality, is pleading with Congress to stop spending so much money on the troops. Through 9 years of war, service members have seen a healthy rise in pay and benefits, with most of them now better compensated than workers in the private sector with similar experience and education levels. Congress has been so determined to take care of troops and their families that, for several years running, it has overruled the Pentagon and mandated more generous pay raises than requested by George W. Bush and Obama administrations. It also has rejected attempts by the Pentagon to slow soaring health care costs, which Defense Secretary Robert M. Gates has said are eating us alive by raising co-pays and premiums. Now Pentagon officials see fiscal calamity. In the midst of two long-running wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, defense officials are increasingly worried that the government's generosity is unsustainable and that it will leave them with less money to buy weapons and take care of equipment. With Washington confronting record deficits, the Pentagon is bracing for an end to the huge increases in defense spending for the past decade. On Saturday, Gates is scheduled to give a hard-hitting speech in Kansas on fiscal discipline, in which he will warn military leaders that we'll have to take some dramatic measures ourselves to sustain the force we have, his press secretary, Jeff Morrell, told reporters. Well, if he's in Kansas, why doesn't he just stop off at Leavenworth and throw himself in it?
I agree with you. I mean, this whole thing is crazy.
Yeah.
Absolutely insane.
Yeah. That's not the whole article, but I'll put the link to it so you can read the rest for yourself. But, yeah, isn't that something?
Well, and this is what we've tried to tell our listeners for such a long time, and why I came out a couple months ago and just railed on the Pentagon. And I will continue to do it. They all get them out. All that Pentagon, as well as that Congress, needs a big sweep out. I found this mail. It's kind of interesting. It's only a couple paragraphs. Take me 2 minutes. This is a reporter, actually a novelist, by the name of Molly Panner Downs. And she wrote down for the New Yorker magazine what she saw when they announced the ceasefire. So she's looking out on Piccadilly Square. This is her observations. First, a little paragraph here. Besieged on all fronts, representatives of Nazi Germany signed the surrender documents, ending the greatest conflict ever to envelop Europe on May 7th. The fighting was to cease at 11:01 a.m. the next day. 6 years of bloodshed were over. Word of the anticipated surrender had been circling for days. There were two celebratory false starts, one on April 28th, another on the morning of May 7th. But finally, the announcement of cessation of fighting was broadcast on the evening of May 7th, and the world at one time erupted in spontaneous joy. You picture that for a minute. The whole world was enveloped in this war. And remember, the war to end all wars wasn't far removed from their memory either. This is Molly Panter Downs. This is what she writes. When the day finally came, it was like no other day that anyone can remember. It had a flavor all its own. An extra-temporaneous, that's what she says, which gave it something of the quality of a vast, happy village lawn fete as people wandered about, sat, sang, and slept against a slimmer background of trees. Apparently, the desire to assist in London's celebration combusted spontaneously with every member of every family, from the smallest baby to the tallest man, with their hair done up in red, white, and blue ribbons, to beaming elderly couples who, without self-consciousness, strolled up and down the street arm in arm in red, white, and blue paper hats. Even the dogs wore immense tricolored bows. The bells had begun to peal, and after the night storm, London was having that perfect hot summer day, one which sometimes feels it is to be found only in the imaginations of poets. The girls in their thin, bright dresses heightened the impression that the city had been taken over by an enormous family picnic. The number of extraordinarily pretty young girls, who presumably are hidden on working days inside the factories and government offices, was astonishing. Strolling with their uniformed boys, arms candidly about each other, they provided a constant gay, simple, marginal decoration to the big, solemn moments of the day. The crowds milled back and forth between Buckingham Palace, Westminster, Trafalgar Square, and Piccadilly Circus. By lunchtime in the circus, the buses had to slow to a crawl in order to get through the tightly packed laughing people. Everybody appeared determined to see the King and Queen and Mr. Churchill all at one time, and few could have been disappointed. They sat jammed together in an affectionate mass, swinging their legs over the sides, wearing each other's uniform caps, calling down to everyone below and above and to the side. "My God," someone said, "think of a flying bomb coming on us." When a firecracker went off, a hawker with a tray of tin brooches fell up in the air, and everybody laughed. "It's all right, mate. It's one of ours." For the first time, London rejoiced. It was without any doubt Churchill's day. Thousands of King George subjects wedged themselves in front of the palace throughout the day, chanting ceaselessly, "We want to see the king," and cheering themselves hoarse when he and the queen and their daughters appeared. But when the crowd saw Churchill, I'm going to cry, there was a deep roar. He was at the head of a procession of members of Parliament, walking back to the House of Commons from the traditional St. Margaret's Thanksgiving service. Instantly, he was surrounded by people, screaming, "Winnie, thank you. You saved England. Thank you, Winnie." One of two happily soggled, very old and incredibly dirty cockneys who had been engaged in a slow shuffling dance, like a couple of Shakespearean clowns. "I love him. That's our old bald Winnie," he said. But it was the American soldiers and laughing girls. They formed conga lines down the middle of Piccadilly Square. The Americans rejoiced with us, and we with they. It was a night and a day of no fixed plan and no organized merriment. Each group danced its own dance, sang its own song, went its own way. The most tolerant, self-effacing people in London on VE Day were the police. They just stood there. They didn't have to do anything. They just smiled benignly while soldiers swung one arm by arm with their women and their ladies and their friends. There were just laughing groups of people from all over the world rejoicing. There were evening bonfires, but all I can remember is the laughter. The young service men and women were rejoicing. Tears joyfully. Joyfully first. They were the liberated people who liberated people. Like their counterparts in every celebrating capital, that night on the planet. They were young enough to outlive the past and look forward to the future. That's amazing to me. And they're dying, and we're doing nothing to remember this. And I don't understand that, Mel. I can't get it. I don't understand. We're their children. We're their children. And they're either dying or they're getting too old and they're starting to forget. Nobody talked about it today. And now the world's at war again, and nobody sees it at war. Where Churchill was, we're like mini Churchills out here screaming there's a gathering storm, and nobody's seeing it. And the thunder's here, and the lightning's here, and everything's falling down, and people are dying, but nobody cares. And this woman writes so wonderfully just about what she saw. I can't even imagine. I want to feel that. But I don't think I ever will, because, you see, they had to go through the darkness to get to that place of joy. And that one line where she wrote, they were the liberated and the liberators. Think about that. Think of the horrors they saw when they had to go into those concentration camps. To this day, those people won't talk about it to you. It's too much. But on this day, 65 years ago, even though they knew all of what was to come ahead, they put their backs into making a future, but they had to fight the war to get there. And this is why I say, why do we always constantly go from the Declaration of Independence to the Constitution, and we forget that in the middle of that, we had to fight a war, a bloody revolution. I'm ashamed that this country did not remember this day. I'm ashamed of it. And I'm ashamed of the president. And I'm ashamed of members of Congress that I had to look to the capitals of Europe.
No, they're only worried about saving their own asses right now with the bank bailout.
I know that takes precedence. I know it's important, believe me, but I'm sorry I got emotional. I apologize.
No need to apologize.
But I can't, you know, I look at my father, I look at his generation, and to them, it was just something that they had to do. If you have anybody that's still around you, talk to them. Ask them what it was like. Ask them what we need to do now. I remember after 9/11. And I think it was George W. Bush that actually reached out through his father to the World War II generation to go and start talking to people. But that fades away, and I wish it wouldn't have. They were there for us then, 9 years ago. They knew what we had to do. They were the strong ones. I remember my father saying, "This is your war now. This is your Pearl Harbor. You will need to make us proud, and it's going to be hard to do. This generation will have to fight a bloody war. But we can do it. We've done it before, and we'll do it again." And now, 9 years later, I'm going, well, I think they skipped to the end. Because our soldiers died. I'm not going to say they died in vain, because they didn't. But we're sending more over there, and I don't know what we're sending them for anymore. For what? Sharia law? That's what McChrystal said? No. I'm not going to have them fight for Sharia law to be used in the villages of Afghanistan. No. I have no president. He should have been leading this nation and reminding this nation of what occurred. But because he has no connection to this country by birth, by whatever, he doesn't want to have a connection. He can't bring himself to do it. The words are empty, and he is empty. Every child should know about this day. Every adult, no, like Mel said, it's going to be all about, and I know it's important. Believe me, we know right now, we talk about it. But you got to fight the war to get there, and we're not doing that. And until we do, we're just spinning around in some sort of really bad B-horror film. Or you're just going to see riots. We're going to live in a constant state of what? Chaos. And what do they love more, the enemy, than anything else? Chaos. We are feeding our enemy. We are giving them the energy they need, day after day. Whether it be socialism, communism, or Islamofascism, we're feeding it by our own ignorance and our lack of patience and our lack of will to do what we have to do. And I am ashamed of this country, that we couldn't take a day, one day, out of the whole year, to thank a generation that saved your butt. You think they wanted to go? No, they didn't. They were scared to death. They were young boys. They did what they had to do. Then they died. Yes, it's a bad thing, and yes, it's sad, and it's okay to be sad. That's why she writes, it was a day of joy, and a day of, it was so mixed up. But to see the whole world rejoice, I just don't think I'll ever see it. That's a shame. It's a real shame. But to that generation, I love you and thank you. We remember. We try. We do what we can. Right, Mel?
Yeah.
And to Mel's uncles, thank you.
Yeah. All three of them, my mom just put their pictures up in a one of those long horizontal frames, so they're all in there. Yeah, my Uncle Steve was in Europe for right from the start. My Uncle Geza, he was in the Philippines. He was wounded there, lost the kidney. He witnessed the Bataan Death March. And my Uncle Mike, he was in Okinawa towards the end of the Pacific War, and he was in occupied Japan, where he almost bought the farm there, too. There was there was a Japanese soldier on the guard check, I think it was, and the guy, he was out on patrol or on guard duty that night, shot him just before he jumped on with a bayonet. So thank you to them. Thank God they're dead now, because they can't be seeing what's going on now. But thanks all to everybody who served in that great war.
Amen. And again, I'm sorry I got so emotional.
Thank you everyone for being here tonight. And if everybody could listen in, give a listen to Anthony J. Schindler's show. He's on Sunday nights at 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern time. Good show. Listen in. Might learn something. Or maybe you can give him a few pointers, too.
Yeah.
And catch our show on Wednesday night at 9:30 p.m. Eastern time, where we'll try to make sense of all this nonsense. And remember, everyone, this is very important. Have a great week ahead, too. Remember, everyone, have your pet muzzy spayed or neutered. Good night, everyone.
Good night. See you guys once.
I'll be alone.